The Snake River Killer podcast is tracking multiple active and cold cases. This investigation is happening in real time. All individuals named and unnamed in this podcast are innocent until proven guilty by a court of law. This episode contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
Where is Christina White?
Who is the suspect?
Detective Jackie Nichols believes there may be a connection between Christina White's disappearance, the murders of Christina Nelson and Brandy Miller, as well as the disappearance of Stephen Pearsall.
All suspected to have fallen victim at the hands of another. Law enforcement made a critical discovery shortly after the murders of Miller and Nelson.
The man that was working in the theater that night lived at the home where Christina White disappeared from.
He was very odd himself. He was more creepy, scary odd.
Opposed to the drawdown, so I agree with that, being suspicious.
She was on the porch and she waved goodbye, and that was the last time I saw her.
Hey everybody, Brandon Schrand here. Before we dive in, I want to thank our newest Patreon supporters, KD, Jason H., Brian, Billy, Wendy, Kenneth, Joseph, Maylee, Corey, and Kyle. If you aren't a Patreon member, consider becoming one. Supporters get discounts on merch, early access to episodes, and exclusive video and audio content. Moreover, your support allows us to continue this show without commercials. For instance, some of the video content for Tiers 2 and 3 on Patreon include me driving the exact route Kristen David rode her bike on the day she vanished. There is also a video of a chance meeting between me and Gloria at the Civic Theater, and we walk around the theater and talk about those cases. Additionally, I filmed the route from the Civic Theater to the location where Christina Nelson's and Brandy Miller's bodies were found. And I'm also excited to announce that David Blaskowitz, who you might recall was on episode 5, he was the former technical director for the Civic Theater. He sent me a VHS tape of the play Footlight Frenzy that he directed back in the mid-80s, starring Lance Voss and Claudette Voliva. Now, I converted that VHS tape to a digital file, and if you want to see Lance acting in the Civic Theater and hear his voice, then become a Patreon member at the third tier and you can watch the show. Also, I will be putting up more content such as extended interviews, behind-the-scenes videos, and more. So again, consider joining by going to Patreon and searching for Snake River Killer, or by following the link in the show notes. Remember in the last episode when I mentioned that the highway leading to the Lake Berryessa murders was Highway 128? I wasn't the only one who saw that connection. Listener Matthew Kruger also found that connection and emailed me, so thank you, Matthew. If I hadn't been looking at the gimmick rallies, I wouldn't have seen that. So keep writing in with your tips and your questions. I do try to get all of them, but some might slip through the cracks. If you don't hear from me, don't hesitate to give me a nudge. Finally, you should be aware that we are covering a lot of ground in this episode. This is one of those shows that is going to have a lot of moving parts, many dimensions, and numerous layers. So apologies in advance for the amount of content, again, coming your way. I want to call your attention to something that I found as I was getting ready to publish Episode 15, East Bay Connections. I knew I needed to send Sam the news clipping announcing the gimmick rally that was to be held on November 28, 1969. But I was on my laptop and didn't have a copy of it, so I went back into the newspaper archives website and searched for it again. But this time, I got a hit I hadn't seen before. On November 27, 1969, the Oakland Tribune ran a listing of all upcoming motor events in the East Bay area. Also occurring on November 28th was another type of navigational rally, the 9th Annual Turkey Toddler Rally, spelled R-A-L-L-Y-E. This particular rally had its starting point as the parking lot of the White Front Department Store. Now that caught me short. Why? Because as you will recall, Leona Roberts worked at White Front, and it was at the White Front store that she was last seen alive. But then I looked at it a little closer and realized that this rally was starting out of the White Front parking lot in Fremont, California, not Pleasant Hill. So that's what I would call a swing and a miss. I pinged some of the team members, quote, not the same white front, end quote. Kathy wrote back, quote, I still think you're onto something, and we should compile a list of rallies to see if they match to any other disappearances or murders, end quote. She went on to say that the activity and crowd cover reminded her of Bundy in the Lake Sammamish abductions. And of course, that reminded me of Christina White and the Assotin County Fair. Crowd cover might be something to look at more closely. Anyway, I want to return to something that came up in episodes 12 and 13 concerning the Notes Plus article. And that has to do with Lance including Charleston and not Clarkston as his residence. At first, I had wondered if Charleston might have been an anagram, a word jumble. But then a listener pinged me shortly after the episode dropped with some information, and then Sam made the same connection that is definitely worth our attention. So Sam and I got on a call.
I was at Christmas, and my dad's neighbors / best friends came over, and Kathy's a listener of the show, and we got to talking about the podcast, and she's like, I just love it so much, and she kind of mentioned as I was packing up and getting ready to go, she goes, oh, I don't think that Charleston thing was an accident, by the way.
Okay.
And I said, oh, me either, you know, and I brought up the Gran Torino ad, and I said, it's definitely something purposeful. And she goes, yeah, and I wonder if it's tied to the Charleston, Washington community. And I said, what the f*** are you talking about? Apparently, Bremerton, over by Bremerton, there used to be a community called Charleston. And the town of Bremerton kind of encapsulated it or whatever, and so it's not there anymore. But she thinks the Charleston there is a reference to that Charleston.
It's so weird that you say that, because I had a listener reach out to me like a week ago and said the same thing. She's from Bremerton and said, by the way, there was a neighborhood here in Bremerton called Charleston, and there are cold cases connected to it.
Interesting.
And if you'll remember back, Roger Korth, Lance's Navy buddy,
said, they went to Bremerton.
Yeah. He said, if you can find anything in Bremerton, that would be a place to look. And I actually spent some time trying to look in Bremerton for cold cases, but I was only looking for Bremerton, and this listener reached out and said there are cold cases connected to the Charleston neighborhood. And I replied and said, can you send some of those along? And I haven't heard anything back. So your dad's friend knew of this community.
Yeah, she's like, it's kind of gotten taken over by, you know, the Greater Bremerton Incorporated or whatever. It's not really known as Charleston anymore, I guess. But she said, like, back in the day, it was, you know, it was a community.
Did she say anything about any cold cases there?
She didn't mention any. Okay.
So we've got a couple of connections. One, Bremerton's been brought up in the show before with Roger. We know that Lance spent time in Bremerton. I'll have to go back and look at the dates. And we have two people now confirming that there was a community in Bremerton called Charleston. I would like to know where in Bremerton that community is, because I have no idea.
Yeah, me either.
So I don't know if she would be able to maybe identify for us kind of where that area is. I'll ping this listener one more time, because she kind of went quiet, but it was right before the holidays, so super interesting.
About 5 minutes after we hung up, Sam texted me. In all caps, she wrote, quote, Kathy just said Charleston was next to the Naval Yard, end quote. To which I responded, what the actual Why is this important? Well, for a few reasons. Again, recall what Roger Korth, Lance's Navy friend, said back in episode 10.
So I even thought, well, what happens in Bremerton? Because the ship was in there about 6 weeks. Since we weren't really doing things on the ship that I can remember, what did the boy have the chance to do? Was he on liberty? Did he go on leave? Was he back in California? You know, if he was gone for a month, where was he? Then you might be able to put more things to it. Boy, this is kind of a 50-year-old mystery to try and find out.
Because of what Roger had said back in episode 10, and now because of the proximity of Charleston, Washington, and the naval yards in Bremerton, I knew I wanted to check in with Sam and Kathy.
I think both of you guys probably looked for cold cases in the area. I didn't put a lot of time into it, but I didn't find much.
I found something interesting today. I was able to find an article. So this was published January 25th of 1966. And if you remember, that date that he was AWOL from Bremerton for a while was January 7th through the 11th.
7th and the 11th, yeah.
Okay. So there was apparently a case of a prowler, so present in the Bremerton area, a prowler with a history of attempted assault on women, brought a warning today from Police Chief John Pluff for residents to tighten up on their home security. This type generally does not break in and enter, but gains entry through unlocked windows or doors. In this day and age, we have numerous mental problems, and every community, unfortunately, has this type at one time or another. Residents of the city are urged to report any strange occurrences at any hour of the night. So basically just saying, hey, heads up, there's a weirdo.
But check this out. The prowler, a young, soft-spoken man believed to be in his 20s, has been operating in the city since last May. You know, they believe this could be more than one person since May, but in his 20s, so fairly close. He was probably 18.
Yeah, well, and he was tall, so he might have been mistaken for being older. But apparently it was such an issue that this company, actually Parker Lumber, who was in Navy Yard City, which would have been right next to Charleston, was offering free estimates. We do, however, make a small charge for our merchandise, as you'll note below, but they were doing free estimates for family security. Protect your family from the mysterious prowler. And they were offering a special on chain locks and storm doors. So it was enough of a problem that a business in the area was using it as a marketing ploy.
Prowler usually professes to have a knife or a gun. Mm-hmm. Some victims report a knife or what they believe to be a knife was held at their throats. They have been awakened by a flashlight beam in their eyes. Some of the women have been forced or ordered to disrobe. In some instances, they're screaming, frighten the prowler away before this could be accomplished.
That to me sounds like Golden State Killer.
This prowler, whoever he is, Lance or not, sounds like somebody they're trying to test out the waters a little bit. Like, do I want to break in? What works best? Do I tell him I have a knife or a gun? What's most effective?
So I have to say what Sam found really got my attention. Essentially, law enforcement at the time issued a bolo for a mysterious prowler who was active in Bremerton. The article was published again on Tuesday, January 25th, 1966. Given this date, what are the known knowns? Well, we know from official USS Vesuvius logs that the ship left its home port in Concord, California on January 3rd, 1966, plying north up the Pacific coast. Then, on January 6th, the Vesuvius nosed its way into the Puget Sound Naval Yard and docked. We know, too, that the neighborhood adjacent to the Naval Yard was known as Charleston. We know that in his Notes Plus article, Lance's address is listed not as Clarkston, but as Charleston, Washington. We further know that the day after the Vesuvius docks, Lance goes AWOL for 10 hours. That's right. Literally the day after the ship arrives, Voss skips out and is unaccounted for 10 hours. We also know that he went AWOL again 4 days later on January 11th, and this time he was gone for 11 hours, whereabouts unknown. The times for which he was unaccounted for were 7 a.m. until 5 p.m. and 7 a.m. until 6 p.m., respectively. So he was gone during the waking hours, in other words. I checked when the sun rose and set in Bremerton in January of 1966 and found that the sunrise was at 7:58 a.m. and that the sun set at 4:30 p.m. Also, the weather through that stretch of time was uniformly rainy and cloudy with relatively low visibility, temperatures floating in the 40s with highs reaching in the 50s. So he left in the dark and returned in the dark. My question is this. What was he doing during those two full days? Just out sightseeing, or was he up to something else? Could he have been casing houses, watching women or young girls, noting routines and routes, entrances and exits? Maybe. Or maybe not. Maybe he was just literally visiting sites and taking in the city views. But because I have so many questions about Lance's time in Bremerton and the general logistics of how a naval yard works, I knew I wanted to reach back out to Roger Korth, so we got on the phone.
One of our team members, Samantha, found a couple of interesting articles in the Bremerton newspaper. So the Vesuvius docked in Bremerton in mid-January of 66 is when the Vesuvius cruised into Bremerton.
Quick correction on my part. The USS Vesuvius docked in Bremerton on January 6th of 1966.
About 2 weeks later, there was an article in the local paper. It says, mystery prowler case, police advise home security, call us. There was a young man in his 20s breaking into homes at night or around 5 in the morning and wanting women to undress, and he had a knife with him and this kind of thing. Now, Lance Voss, he got reprimanded, as you know from those deck logs, for being absent or unauthorized absence. So he was remanded to the base for about 2 weeks, I think. And it was after this incident in the newspaper, it all stopped after the Vesuvius left. So it could have been someone in Bremerton that was the perpetrator. It could have been someone on the Vesuvius that wasn't Lance Voss. It might not have been related to Lance in any way whatsoever.
You know, once we were in the barracks, if somebody got up in the middle of the night and wanted to walk out, I guess they could, you know, for a smoke break or something like that. As long as it was quiet, we really didn't care much what happened. You show up in the morning to where you're supposed to, and everything is good.
You show up in the morning when you're supposed to, everything's fine.
Pretty much so.
Well, is that part of it because, hey, you're stateside, you know, you're not in Subic Bay. Was the restriction, I mean, was it tighter in Subic Bay or is it about the same?
Well, normally in Subic Bay for the younger guys, you had to be back on the base by midnight. And the last boat going back to our ship might have been at 1 o'clock.
Okay.
And that would allow for stragglers and drunks and whatever the shore patrol brought in.
From the last time, one of the times I talked to you, it sounded like, you know, it was a little different there because you didn't want to get into any ruckus or an altercation with an indigenous person. Maybe guys were more relaxed when they were stateside. Maybe were rules more relaxed, or it's the military and rules are rules.
I mean, the thing is, you know, if you keep your nose clean, no matter where you are, you really don't have any problems.
Okay.
But the thing is, lots of times we would hit the beach in the Philippines, and we've been out at sea for a month, and these guys with hollow legs were bound and determined to get all the drinking they could as fast as they could.
Okay, sure.
And, I mean, if we were in for 3 days, those guys could literally be in stupor position for 3 days.
For the entire time.
Yeah.
Okay. In Bremerton now, as Master at Arms, you weren't actually at the gate of the bases guarding.
No, absolutely not. We had, I think they had maybe federal employees at the gate.
At the gate.
I don't think it was Navy personnel. I you know, that's 58 years ago.
Sure.
So that I'm not sure about.
You'd have to have a pass to clear that gate.
If you were dressed up and you had liberty, I think you just went. When you came back, you show your ID card and they let you back in. It wasn't like a prison or anything. There were a lot of civilian employees there and people going in left and right. Just like going on a college campus, actually.
I guess what I'm driving at, and you can already guess this, is would it have been possible for Lance to slip through the gates and, you know, prowl around Bremerton and then come back? And as long as he was back for, and we know that sometimes he wasn't back for his duty, and that's why he got reprimanded, but maybe, you know, it was possible.
Well, that's it. See, I don't think it would be too hard to get off.
Okay.
Because it wasn't really that military restrictive.
Okay.
Like, to get off the ship, that was a little harder.
Sure.
You know, you got to go past the quarterdeck, and I have to say, you know, somebody has to come up to me and say, request permission to leave the ship. And you'd mark them down to who they were, something like that. Like when you look at the logs and you see Port Shore Patrol or something like that.
Yeah.
That way the Navy knew where I was. If I didn't come back, well, last time we saw him, he was on Shore Patrol.
So according to Roger, the base in Bremerton was pretty much come and go. But also according to Roger, Lance could have just as easily come and gone during the rest of his time in Bremerton. My point is that those 2 days weren't the only opportunities he had to get out. Also in a follow-up message, I asked if Lance could have left the base when he was restricted for being absent without leave, and he thought it was more than possible, just because things were so relaxed at the time. According to the article Sam found, entry into victims' homes was, quote, always through an unlocked door or window and always in the hours of darkness, but not necessarily at night, either around midnight or 5:30 in the morning, just before daylight, end quote. Those details ought to sound familiar to you because they did to me. Why? Because Voss was arrested for trying to enter the Willow Glen mortuary through a back window, not in the middle of the night, but at 5 a.m. And in the Civic Theater case, Lance placed himself as returning to the theater around 5 a.m. on September the 13th. Anyway, the article goes on to say how, quote, the prowler usually professes to have a knife or a gun. Some victims report a knife, or what they believe to be a knife, was held to their throats. They have been awakened by a flashlight, end quote. Again, we know from the mortuary break-in that Lance had with him both a knife and a flashlight. All that said, the biggest piece of intel that points away from Lance as the mysterious prowler is that these incidents had been occurring since the previous May. Now, of course, not all of the incidents may have been perpetrated by the same individual, but the more I learn about the nature of these crimes, the less likely I find that it was the work of several people. Moreover, if these incidents were the work of one individual, which seems to have been the assumption of law enforcement at the time, and if each incident looked identical or at least similar, then it's likely not Lance. Additionally, this prowler wasn't just a rando slinking through back alleys and rummaging through unlocked cars and garages. No, this prowler had other things in mind, things with a paraphiliac or violent and sexual bent to them. Nevertheless, after January 30th, 1966, news of this prowler vanished from the paper. Nothing else was reported, no more mention, no more cautions to the community, and apparently no more incidents filed. So in the case of Charleston, Washington, the mysterious prowler comes kinda close to matching Lance's own behavior at the Willow Glen mortuary, and Lance Voss quite possibly listed Charleston, Washington as his residence in the Notes Plus article. So we can draw some lines there, but pretty close and a few lines aren't exactly tantamount to concrete evidence. That is why I reached out to the Bremerton Police Department, issuing a public disclosure request for any and all incidents reported surrounding these cases. I sent the request for a couple of reasons. First, because there are enough parallel facts between their prowler in January of 1966 and Lance that it would be good to get more info so as to rule him in or out. And second, I think it's a good idea to begin putting his name on the radar of law enforcement agencies serving areas in which he was present. Of course, I would imagine the FBI has already done this, but I figured pinging them again couldn't hurt. Anyway, 2 days later, I received a response from the Bremerton PD. They didn't have anything in their records. So that pretty much ends our inquiry along those lines, at least for now. If any of you have any more information about this prowler or incidents occurring in the Bremerton-Charleston area in 1966, reach out, let us know. Moving forward, I want to pivot here and refresh our sense of Lance's timeline and where it leads us to next. To recap, recall that 2 years after his stint in Bremerton in 1968, he separated from the United States Navy as unfit for service, moved in with his mother Jane and stepfather Joseph Nepudi in Saratoga, California. From 1969 to 1971, Voss attended West Valley Community College. There, he took an array of classes ranging from computer automation, Shakespeare, marketing, beginning typing, business law, real estate practicum, concert band, fencing, general psychology, and early childhood development. In 1970, Karen Dill visited Lance and stayed with him at his parents' house. It was during that visit that he recalled the story of when she bit him after he put his hand over her mouth. In 1972, Lance Voss was arrested for breaking into the Willow Glen mortuary with a camera, flashlight, and knife, and the body of 17-year-old Antoinette Anino was the only body in the mortuary. During the same time period, he was employed variously at Wiener Schnitzel, Lake Berryessa School District, and Auto City. He was residing at 3201 Cadillac Drive, San Jose, around the corner from Rosemary Elementary School and 2,500 feet from Del Mar High School, where Antoinette Anino had previously attended. In 1973, he married his first wife, Victoria. He was 26, she was 18. She was fresh out of Fremont High School, where she was active as a representative of Girls League and active in the Mother's Tea Club. While I have tried numerous times to reach out to Victoria, she's not responded. She's not on social media and for all intents and purposes has gone underground. Gloria, on the other hand, did have occasion to speak with her years ago, so I wanted to check in with her to see what she had in her notes about that marriage. Oh, and by the way, in this interview with Gloria, you'll hear me mention Lance's second wife, Debbie, and their daughter, Rebecca. I did have a chance to interview Debbie, and you'll learn about how that interview went soon enough.
You know, when I talked to her, Brandon, when she found out Voss is living on the East Coast or in the Eastern States, she didn't like that. She told me to be careful. And then all of a sudden, she's no longer in New Jersey. She's over in. And I have tried everything I can to get a hold of her. Emails.
I have too.
No response. Looking back, she could hold some information that could be helpful to us.
I mean, they were married in 73, it looks like, divorced in 74, 7 months. And just trying to track information down on her from even back in the time was like pulling teeth.
The one thing that Vicky said to me, and I thought it was really interesting, she said he told her he had a low sperm count.
That's weird. Yeah,
it is weird. So that kind of got me thinking about that. It's like, well, did he get somebody pregnant? I mean, a lot of things, a lot of questions right there.
I just don't know why he would volunteer that information. I mean, it's...
Yeah, it just sounds kind of funny. It's like, was he trying to say, if you get pregnant, it's not mine? It just is very odd.
Well, did you catch the part in my interview where Debbie said that Lance's mom, who lived 5 minutes away from her, wanted nothing to do with Rebecca?
Yes.
Her own granddaughter, zip, nothing.
That to me was like, wow, why wouldn't you want to see your grandchild? So it raises questions about her too.
And her relationship back to Lance. I think from armchair psychologist, if I'm looking at it, Lance is the apple of her eye or something, and anybody else is a threat, right? Like, that could be it. I don't know what it is. It also could be that Lance denied that Rebecca was his daughter and told his mom, she's not mine.
We don't know what went on behind the scenes there, but you can see there's the physical likeness.
Oh, yeah.
And then his grandson he went into the Navy, looks just like him, except he's got dark hair.
Yeah, it's kind of creepy.
Part of her not having much of a memory of that, of Voss, I think she's tried to block it. I really do. Because when I talked to her, it was almost the same conversation. She just didn't want to remember.
That's the sense that I got.
And Vicky, the last known place that she was at was in, but she had very clear memories of him. And I wish I knew then what I know now, because I would have had far more questions for her. But for her to genuinely not want to be on the same side of the United States that he was spoke volumes.
Yeah.
She was very nervous. And it wasn't a pretend nervous. It was genuine.
What all do you remember from talking with her?
He wasn't working when she was with him. And she told me he had terrible scarring on his leg. And because the injury was in 68, in the middle of, it was July, you would think in 70, he might have had a limp. By 72, 73, he should have been recovered. So my thought is maybe he's pulling a Bundy. But she did mention his leg. I asked her if he had any quirks, sexual quirks. She said, no. She had to ride public transit while he had the car, and he would go all over the place. So he was free all day. His schedule was his own schedule. It was like she put him up in room and board. She paid for everything. She worked. He didn't. She said he was sloppy. He was a slob. the dishes, going out and shooting them.
Instead of washing the dishes, he would take them outside
and shoot them
with his gun.
Yes. And I would love to know where he was out shooting. You know, where did you go? She didn't say what kind of gun. I'm terribly curious to know all the guns that he had access to. And if you think about his cousin Marjorie, she's in the military. Most people that are in the military own guns. So what did he have access to there? And if he put everything in his mother's name, did he have guns in his mother's name?
Ah, good question.
I mean, if he doesn't want anything traced back to him.
If he put his cars in his mom's name, it's not a stretch to think that he might have put firearms in her name too.
Exactly, exactly. Especially firearms that are not common.
Quick interjection here. When I was putting this episode together and re-listening to Gloria and I speaking about his guns and whether or not he may have registered any under his mother's name, I was reminded of something odd I found that very morning. It was a comment Lance had made in one of his Google group posts back in 1996. Now recall that his group chats is where he was talking about the French horn and how he had a junior high student who was 5 feet tall and 100 pounds. Well, in a post discussing taxes, Voss was agreeing to disagree with another person on the chat as to who was to blame for high taxes, Republicans or Democrats. In the comment, Lance borrows a phrase from that person he's arguing with, so what I'm about to read you will have a quote within a quote. Lance wrote, quote, "Where you and I differ is that you see the threat to opportunity being rich Republicans, quote, sending forth the tax collector to confiscate the farmers' chickens so that the king may wage war to protect our way of life," end quote. Then, in parentheses, Lance wrote, quote, "I really like that analogy. I hope you don't mind if I file the serial numbers off and reuse it," end quote. Anyway, I guess I'm just bringing it up here because it's such a weird thing to say, filing the serial numbers off of a phrase, and it immediately popped into my mind when I was listening to Gloria and I discuss his guns. Now, I don't know if he was just being clever or if he couldn't help himself or if it was another kind of cognitive leak or another demonstration of duping Delight. I just don't know, but it's one of those phrases that really leaped out to me because it feels intentional somehow. And while we're on this quick sidebar, I want to share another comment from that same time in another post, only this time on Social Security, and how Voss saw it as government welfare. In the post, Lance wrote, quote, "I note that it was recently uncovered that during the time that the notorious freeway killer was on death row, awaiting execution for killing dozens of people, he was receiving Social Security checks due to the fact that he was, quote, mentally ill, unquote, therefore disabled and unable to work," end quote. I call your attention to this one, too, for obvious reasons. But also this. As I've alluded to previously, when you look at the totality of his writing, there is a preoccupation with death, and now serial killers. And if not a preoccupation with death, then a preoccupation with language that is related to or adjacent to the act of killing or death. Anyway, we'll put screenshots of those Google chats on our website, snakeriverkiller.com. For now, I want to jump back into my conversation with Gloria.
She talked about the car racing.
The rally events?
Yeah, he would go out and do that.
Without her, it sounds like.
Without her. Exact. She never went with him. She also talked about his cousin Marjorie, who was a little flaky. She said she used to keep tissue down her shirt. She wasn't quite all there. So,
interesting.
Was there some dementia going on there?
She had met Marjorie then.
Yes.
The one in the military, the one that lived 700 miles away in San Francisco.
Yes.
Interesting.
And she said that, you know, keeping tissue down her shirt, and she was just one of those people that you knew wasn't right. And now, like I said, in hindsight, she could be an absolute wealth of information.
So a few things really stick out to me about what Gloria said. First, that Lance had evidently told Victoria that he had a low sperm count, which on its face is odd. Not that he had a low sperm count, but that he told her that, and that was something that apparently struck her as odd. Odd enough that she remembered it all these years later. Second, that he was a slob and that instead of washing dishes, he took them outside and shot them with a firearm. That's just bizarre on so many levels that I don't even know how to process it. For one thing, it establishes that he had a gun in 1973, and likely earlier. It also establishes that he used it to, what exactly, make a chauvinist statement against a domestic chore? I mean, was that action a kind of tacit and or passive aggressive threat toward Victoria? I don't know, but it's another one of those things that gives us some insight into his mind. The third thing is that he was unemployed and took the car for long periods of time while she relied on public transit to get to and from work. As in so many other instances, I again have to ask, where was he during these hours and what the hell was he doing with his time? And just to really highlight this time period, because it could be important, Lance and Victoria were married from August 4th, 1973 until March of 1974. Any cases in the Greater Bay Area during this time period are cases that, in my estimation, ought to be looked at, and I hope that we can get to those, because there are several. Finally, the big takeaway was that Victoria, who has family ties in New Jersey, evidently felt threatened enough that she moved to the other side of the country when she learned that he lived in North Carolina, and after that, she effectively became a ghost. But don't worry, I'm still trying to connect with her. In all, Lance and Victoria's marriage lasted 7 months. In 1974, the same year he and Victoria divorced, Lance bought 18 acres and a small ramshackle house on a swatch of Pan Flat, Idaho farmland in the Mormon village of Melba, population at the time of about 200 souls. Although he purchased the property in 1974, he did not move to Idaho then, not yet anyway. Rather, he remained in San Jose. And here, there are so many questions that have nagged at me ever since I learned about Lance Voss and these cases. Why, when, and under what circumstances did he move to his own private Idaho in the first place? And why Idaho, of all states? And I say that as a fifth-generation Idahoan. Parts of the state are beautiful, breathtaking even, but Melba isn't one of those places. It's the most flyover of towns in what is probably one of the most flyover states. For those of you unfamiliar with the general geography of Idaho, Melba is nowhere close to Lewiston, Idaho or Clarkston, Washington, way up north. Melba is about 300 miles south of the Lewis-Clark Valley. If you can picture Idaho like a giant boot, Melba is down near the heel and the LC Valley is up near the calf. Distance-wise, it would be like getting your car in Philadelphia and driving north all the way to Boston. But in that case, you'd pass through about four states and skirt a fifth, but in Idaho, you stay in the same state the entire time. It's big country, in other words. Wild, remote, and sparsely populated, especially in 1974. Because I needed some clarity on his property, I pinged Gloria. She sent me the property deeds and a note saying, quote, "Florence and I walk the property," end quote. I knew what that meant. She and Florence Dickens, a cadaver dog handler and Snake River Killer podcast collaborator, had taken dogs out on that property, but the dogs did not alert on anything. Like the unremarkable landscape that surrounded it, Lance's property squatted on what is called the Snake River Plain, flat as far as you can see, almost all farmland. This is high desert country. What isn't irrigated and cultivated is largely sandy and dotted with sagebrush and Russian olive trees, spindly poplars, and occasional cottonwoods blotting the horizon. Craggy and knuckled stretches of basalt ridges are typical of the Snake River Plain and its volcanic past. The only thing Melba has in common with either San Jose or the Lewis-Clark Valley is its proximity to water, or in this case, the Snake River itself. In fact, Lance's property and derelict house stood 3 miles from the banks of the Snake River. Having 18 acres in the middle of nowhere, Idaho, near a massive river within walking distance, would be attractive only to a radically niche group of people. Farmers, anglers, or recreationalists, with those latter two categories pretty much overlapping one another, and little else. That comprises the core group of people who would be even remotely interested in that kind of place. And importantly, at least for us, Lance was and remains none of those things. He was not a farmer, he was not an angler, and he was not a recreationalist. So why did he purchase land and a house there in a dust-swept parcel of backwater America that most people might call god-awful, especially in the grip of an unforgiving winter? Why indeed? That's the question. Now, of course, I'm aware that in the early to mid-70s, there were all kind of back-to-earthers who were trailing off into rural enclaves in the woods with a bag of weed and a dream. My parents toyed with the idea but never really acted on it, but I well remember the late-night conversations about surviving off the grid and growing your own food, etc. And I'm aware of how those defending Lance, and yes, there are a small but vocal group of them, will say, this is maybe why he moved to the middle of nowhere, Idaho, to get back to the earth. But here's the deal. Lance was a lot of things, but a mushroom-foraging, commune-curious, Grizzly Adams hippie type wasn't one of them. He was anything but. So again, why? In order to answer that question or set of questions, I knew I had to get back to that period to figure out what was going on and to talk with anyone close to him at the time. As it happens, it wasn't long after his divorce from Victoria that he married his second wife, Debbie. Although Lance and Debbie would marry in 1976, they met 6 years earlier, in 1970, while attending West Valley Community College in San Jose. And just so you aren't confused, I'll clarify. Lance met Debbie 2 years before marrying Victoria. So in 1976, Lance and Debbie, having evidently reunited, got married. Shortly thereafter, Debbie became pregnant with a girl. And while I knew that Gloria had spoken with Debbie many, many years ago, I knew that I wanted to speak with her myself, to see what I could learn, if anything. But tracking her down was proving difficult. Until recently, anyway. I was able to chance upon two mobile numbers that may have been connected to her. I texted both and waited. Nothing. Days went by, and still nothing. Then, a text bloomed on my screen. It read, quote, "Yes, I was married to Mr. Voss. Don't think I have much information," end quote. I wrote back, quote, "I understand. Thanks so much for getting back to me. It means a lot. I would love the chance to talk on the phone, if only briefly. I only have a few questions," end quote.
Hello?
Hi, is this Debbie?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Debbie. This is Brandon Schrand. How are you?
Alrighty.
Thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me. I really appreciate it.
The Snake River Killer is a production of Resuscitate Media, LLC. I'm the host, Brandon Schrand. Original music is written and performed by the Young Night Drifters. Special thanks to Blake Walker, our engineer, associate producers and investigators, Gloria Boberts and Paul Dale, graphic designer, web guru, and investigator, Sam Sawyer, researcher and forensic science consultant, Kathy Belbin, research consultant and criminologist, Dr. Marianne White, research assistant, Tina Landriotti, canine and field search consultant, Florence Dickens, and her dog, Caven. Special thanks to Jenny Anderson and Vernon Locke for letting us air portions of their documentary, Confluence. Be sure to join us online at snakeriverkiller.com, where you can find photos, articles, maps, timelines, links, and where you can order your own Snake River Killer merch. And don't forget to join us on Patreon, where you can get access to exclusive content such as video footage, extended interviews, behind-the-scenes content, and much more. Next time on the Snake River Killer. One day, she found a badger, frozen solid, in her freezer. She just believed that he did it, quote, "to screw with my head," end quote.
The grandchild obviously is physical proof that your son has had a physical relationship with a woman.
Known as the real-life inspiration for both Norman Bates of Psycho and Leatherface in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Gain was a 51-year-old bachelor who lived on his family farm outside the quiet village of Plainfield, Wisconsin.
He loved the idea of having sex with someone who is dead because you wouldn't get caught. No feelings. She wouldn't feel it.
Wait, wow, what? That's sounding really close to the wheelhouse of what we know about Lance Voss, because he broke into a mortuary with a camera, a flashlight, and a knife.